From my home studio, welcome to Evolve, groundbreaking Jewish conversations.
We've had some sirens and we've had to go into safe rooms, but very little compared to a lot of other places. But everything really changed on October 7th in many ways.
I'm your host, Brian Schwartzman, and today we'll be speaking with Rabbi Haviva Ner David, an Israeli writer and peace activist. We'll be discussing a few of her recent Evolve essays, including The Other Side of the Rain, At the Cemetery in the Galilee, and Let Not Our Anger Blind Us, Jews and Palestinians in Israel. We'll also be referencing some of her post-October 7th articles for the Times of Israel and be linking to those in our show notes. Haviva is a repeat guest on our show, and I've gotten to know her a bit outside the podcast. And this wasn't an easy conversation. It's kind of the difference between knowing a friend is facing a tough situation and checking in and really hearing the details. We'll be discussing some of her personal losses that Haviva suffered on October 7th and after, what it's like to live next door to a member of Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling coalition government, and how her thinking has changed in the months since October 7th. We'll also be talking about what she and others are advocating for right now. And today I'm in luck. With me for this interview is Rabbi Jacob Staub, my friend, executive producer, standing breakfast date. Jacob directs Evolve and edits our website, evolve.reconstructingjudaism.org. Jacob, it's great to have you in the virtual booth today.
Great to be here, Brian.
Excellent. So Jacob, you've as an editor, you've asked Haviva to write a trio of Israel-related posts in the last year. She'd written something before October 7th that was much more inspired and related to the year of protests that preceded it. I'm wondering if you could say anything about what it is about her writing that you've wanted to bring to the discussion on Israel, Palestinians, war, and peace. Why is this someone we keep going back to get her take?
Great question, Brian. I consider Haviva, who is also a spiritual director who works with some of the students at the Reconstruction Rabbinical College, to be pretty unique as a character on the Israeli scene. I knew of her first because of the mikveh that she runs at Kibbutz Hanaton in the Galil, in the Galilee, which is, I don't know, I think it may be the only non-Orthodox mikveh where you can do lots of creative things and she helps you to do them. So she's really a figure of spiritual breadth, and she does a lot of interfaith work, but specifically on the Palestinian, Israeli, Jewish front, she is front line. She is there across the road from a Palestinian village from Hanaton, and she does joint work with them and really creative joint programming for teenagers and has not abandoned that kind of work during this war. She has maintained those relationships and has gone really full steam on Omdim Biyachad, this new emerging, quickly growing Israeli organization, movement, Standing Together, which is composed of Jewish and Palestinian Israelis who advocate for some kind of of real accommodation within the state of Israel. For all of those reasons, and the fact that she's an accomplished novelist and a fine writer, it's maybe that I go back to her too often in terms of frequency of a single contributor, but I always think of her when I want to know what's going on in the Israeli heart and mind in the middle of this crisis.
And also the parent of seven children. So it's hard to imagine somebody more invested in this for those reasons. And I also think that there's something almost iconoclastic about her. Like if we listen to this, if you've got more of a center or right leaning perspective, she's going to say things that will challenge you. But I think also if you're coming at this as a member of the left, she's going to say things that are challenging. So I just thought that brings something refreshing to this discussion where folks seem kind of locked in the fixed position. So thanks. So before we get to our guest, just note, if you want to stay up to date on the latest essays, videos, and podcasts from Evolve, sign up for the Evolve newsletter. We'll put the link right in our show notes. We'll make it easy for you. You can also find it easily at evolve.reconstructingjudaism.org.
And yeah, let's just mention, Brian, that we are in the middle of our annual Purim campaign to support the work of the whole Evolve project. And that means if you sign up for the newsletter right now, you will receive two special essays about anti-Semitism, one on Islamic militancy, and one on the right and the left as sources of anti-Semitism in the U.S. If you make a $36 donation, you will get a video. You will get a video of Rabbis David Teutsch and Tova Spitzer talking with me about a whole range of anti-Semitism concerns and issues. And for a $250 donation, if you're really able to be more generous, which we would really appreciate, you will get the full video of Rabbis Spitzer and Teutsch talking about those issues.
We know we don't always want an extra email in our inbox, but this carries resources each month that'll really make it worth it. We'll put a link in our show notes. And you can also find it easily at evolve.reconstructingjudaism.org. Okay, one final note here. This conversation touches on the nature of calls for ceasefires around the world. So our own organization, Reconstructing Judaism, has joined the call for a bilateral ceasefire and release of hostages and surge in humanitarian assistance. You can go to reconstructingjudaism.org to read the full statement, and we'll also have a link in our show notes. All right, let's get to our guest. Rabbi Haviva Nir David is a post-denominational, interspiritual rabbi, spiritual director, and author who has published memoirs, novels, and a children's book. She's also a social activist living on Kibbutz Hanaton in the Galilee. She is active in the group Standing Together, which is a grassroots movement mobilizing Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel in pursuit of peace and a better future. Rabbi Haviva Nir David, welcome. It's good to see you again. It's been a while.
Good to see you too.
How are you doing? I guess I just wanted to start there. How are you doing? How is your immediate family doing?
Yeah. So it's been a roller coaster since October 7th. We're all okay. Where I live in the Galilee, we are far enough from each border that we've had some sirens and we've had to go into safe rooms, but very little compared to a lot of other places. But everything really changed on October 7th in many ways. And so there's just so many things that are difficult right now. So let's see. I mean, first of all, even just the fact that so a lot of people went to go to fight in you know, reserves. So a lot of people from our key will just work on, you know, like that day, the next day. And so there's been a lot of support, people supporting each other in the kibbutz. In general, like all these people from the north and from the south had to leave their homes. And that meant rehousing them. So like every place just opened its doors everywhere where there was an empty apartment, an empty house, an empty institution that had a hotel. The hotels were all filled and still a lot of them are. We have families living on the kibbutz also who came because they were displaced. Then also schooling those kids. So the kids who were living here and the educational center, then we didn't know how long it was going to be. So first, like maybe it's a few days, a few weeks. Then all of a sudden it's like several weeks and these kids need to go to school. So then the schools had, you know, took them in. And so just like adding so many things turned upside down. Let's see, I'm thinking of like every aspect of life. I know I'm missing lots of things. And then there's the hostages, which is a whole other thing and story, and thinking that they would also come home soon after October 7th, and it's just dragging on and on. And then people who we thought were hostages and turned out that they were really killed. So a friend of mine, Vivian Silver, who we thought was a hostage, and then it turned out that she was killed on October 7th, and then we had her funeral, and soldiers. So that's a whole other. So like my son, I have a son who's 20 years old, and he did not do the Army. He did National Service because I have a genetic muscular disease that he also has. So he did National Service, but all his friends were in Gaza, and two were killed already, two of his good friends. And his best friend was wounded, and the guy next to him was killed. But he was wounded in the leg, and he's been in rehab, and he's not going to go back to Gaza. So that's a relief. So I'm just thinking,
wondering
what else?
If we could zoom out a little bit to the larger picture.
Right.
When I talk to Israelis like you, what you're doing is what I get. You know, well, you know, you're busy. You're helping. You're volunteering. You're feeling the effects. And I'm just I sense that there's a real divide that people here outside don't really have a good a feeling of what it was like on October 7th, 8th, 9th, the sense of collective trauma, of vulnerability, of, we end up talking about 1,200 dead, and then you're comparing that to how many Gazans have been killed. But there's something that underneath the numbers, I think, that I'm wondering if you can illuminate a little bit for us.
So I'm sure that it's different being there and being here, no doubt about that. Even just for me, like the difference between being here and being in Gaza feels different. And I know there's death in both places, but I know that, you know, I know some people personally here, so that always feels different. Like even the hostages. So there's all these faces of all the different hostages, but the ones that I have a connection to that I know, then I can like grasp onto those and think about those, or even the ones that you read their stories and then you know their stories. So I do think that it's hard to grasp these large numbers and hard to be far away. What was it like on October 7th itself? So that was here, that was Simchat Torah. One of our sons was in Egypt on a trip, like backpacking around Egypt. And so then all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, Adrian's in Egypt right now. Okay, I think that's not such a good thing. And then like he's WhatsApping with we have a family group and he's saying, I think I should leave. And I can't come back on the bus the way I came. I have to get out of, you know, and so like we had to figure out to get him a ticket, and he didn't want to come to Israel because he said that there were people, he didn't want to take, he wasn't, he's not in the reserves because he was in the army, but he was wounded. And so anyway, he doesn't do reserves. So he said, I don't want to take a place on the plane from somebody who's going back to be in the reserves. So then, so we sent him to Barcelona, where our son, a different son had just started. Wow, I forgot about this. A different son had just started. He was supposed to go for the year to Barcelona in a soccer academy. And he had just left a few weeks ago, and he was, you know, kind of a little homesick. And so he said, oh, I'll go visit him. And he went to Barcelona. In the end, that son came home too the next week because he said he couldn't stay so far away when there was a war going on here. So he's back a long time already. So he's not doing soccer academy. But and there was also some anti-Semitism, you know, it was not a good time to be there. So so that was October. That was like the few days after was getting people home, and then then there was just the shock of it, you know, and as it got bigger and bigger and the magnitude, you know, when the magnitude of it became more clear. And I'm very active in Arab Jewish partnership or Palestinian Israeli Jewish Israeli partnership groups. And that was, I think, the first day, even like by that night, we all realized that it could turn into rioting within the country. And it, there had been, you know, during wars before with Gaza or missions, as they were called, there was that kind of unrest and rioting. And this group Standing Together that I'm involved with the last time around was we were doing a lot of like standing on street corners saying we were against the violence. And so this time we said, okay, let's see if we can try to prevent violence from happening. And so it was like that night, there was a big Zoom meeting around the country of different people involved with Standing Together to talk about what kind of work we could do like on the ground to prevent rioting and violence and hate crimes. And so that we did, and we did, like there have not been riots and hate crimes. And people were doing things like cleaning out shelters together, our Jews, and hanging up signs and giving out flyers and painting signs. We were painting signs saying neighbors, you know, good neighbors even in hard times, and doing all kinds of activities like that to bring people closer together. So that I was very involved with that soon after October 7th already. So that was like a big concern and something. And I'll say that our chapter of Standing Together has actually, I think, doubled in size since October 7th, which is amazing because it could have gone the other way.
Both Palestinians and Jewish Israelis?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, from what I can see in our chapter, yeah, like definitely people of, well, you know, in both communities are definitely, absolutely. Around the country, it's harder for me to tell because I don't, but one thing that's going on in the Arab Israeli community is that there's been a lot of people are very afraid to speak out and speak what they really think, because there have been arrests, there have been like questionings, detaining people, and it's very hard to be an Arab Israeli in general, you know, in terms of one's identity and feeling torn between being Israeli and being Palestinian, but especially in these times when there's a war going on. So my friends, you know, say that it's just very hard because they feel the pain on both sides. And I can say I feel the pain on both sides too, but not to that same extent that if I don't have family or, you know, there.
I was going to ask you whether Jewish Israelis are also afraid to speak out, but it seems less so than here, where people get really shunned if they speak out as being anti-Semitic, as being not loyal. You go to demonstrations, you go to, you feel okay speaking out.
That's interesting, an interesting question. Yeah, because I do. So there's been an evolution, I guess. So that was like the first few weeks, and I was not demonstrating against the war, and nobody was demonstrating against the war, and I didn't even want to demonstrate against the war. You know, at the beginning, I was like, I felt like, you know, we should retaliate. We should do something. We can't just, you know, especially because Hamas were saying that they're going to keep doing this again and again. And like, okay, so how can we can't just sit by and let them do another October 7th. You know, we need to do something. For me, the turning point was when I realized that the people like running this war didn't have any endpoint of like peace. Netanyahu was saying that he wasn't planning to come to any kind of like two-state solution or anything like that. And so for me, that was like, oh, well, what's the point of all this if the endpoint is not peace, it's not some kind of political agreement, something, you know? So then I was like, okay, now I'm against continuing. And that was around the same time that people started to demonstrate against the war. It wasn't so long ago, maybe a couple months ago. So but I didn't feel afraid. I don't know anyone who felt, maybe some Palestinian Israelis felt afraid. I didn't feel afraid, even though there is police brutality at demonstrations. And now we started demonstrating against the government too. Every Saturday night, again, there's those same demonstrations that were happening before the war. So they've started up again.
We're talking in late February. We have a couple week lag till folks will hear this, but I'm just wondering what are you advocating for right now? What is Standing Together advocating for today?
Okay. So first of all, to go to elections, like not municipal only elections, but national elections. It feels that like we can control more what's going on here. You know, I don't feel like I can have an effect on what the Palestinians in Gaza or the West Bank necessarily are going to do and what their leadership's going to be. But here, I feel and we feel that this government has to go. I mean, we knew that before the war, but especially now, that this government is very problematic on so many levels. And so that's a big message of demonstrations right now, is that the government needs to go. But then what does that mean? So it means we need to have elections. And the idea would be that this government should take responsibility for what happened on October 7th and say that they shouldn't be leading anymore. It doesn't look like they're going to be doing that. So that's a question, like, what can we do then? So we can demonstrate, we can try to put pressure on people in the government to resign, because if I think it's 4 or 5 people resign in the government, then the government falls. So that's one thing also on that we can do, and we are doing. On our kibbutz, we have a minister in the government, so a bunch of us have been demonstrating next to his house.
Right, that totally floored me. You have like a member of a right wing government living on a kibbutz. That just seems like, I don't know. I didn't think that happened. We have this image of kibbutz being all left leaning residents. Yeah. So is that just a false assumption or perception, or just an accident of geography? What's going on there?
So some kibbutzim are actually not left-wing, I guess, but we are a liberal Jewish kibbutz, which already tends to, you know, to be more left-wing. And this government isn't just about Palestinians and Jews, right? You know, there's all these other Jewish supremacist kind of attitudes and Orthodox supremacists and all that. So this government, I think it's a good question to ask how it happened out that this minister is living on our kibbutz and
is never. That's Amichai Chikli. How do you say?
Yeah. So he wasn't in politics when he joined the kibbutz, and what people don't usually ask about your politics when you join the kibbutz.
Hmm.
And he grew up in the conservative movement here.
And is this somebody you've been friendly with before this, or, you know, because it's kind of wild, the whole neighbor against neighbor dynamic, which.
Yeah, there are a lot of people in the community who are not happy about us demonstrating. I can definitely say that. Absolutely. So, yeah, but I think I personally feel like you can still be neighbors and be even friends, but if you disagree, I feel like we have a right to peacefully demonstrate in front of this house. We're careful, like our demonstrations are very respectful, I think, and quiet. We don't use megaphones or anything. We just kind of sing and hold signs. So we just want to make our voice heard.
This show is a production of Reconstructing Judaism, and 2024 marks 10 years of Rabbi Deborah Waxman's presidency. Rabbi Waxman has met turbulent times with hope and resolve, projecting a vision of Judaism that lowers barriers, inspires meaningful action, and defends the most vulnerable. Don't miss your chance to be part of a conversation with Waxman about the Jewish present, past, and future. On Wednesday, April 3rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, you'll have the chance to hear from Rabbi Waxman and hear her reflect on her leadership in conversation with other Jewish women leaders. The program is called When Jewish Women Lead, Activating People and Possibilities Through Turbulent Times. We'll include a registration link in our show notes. You can also find it on the events page at reconstructingjudaism.org.
Mention the supremacist elements in the government. That's what we hear a lot about in the U.S., right? Because what they're doing in Gaza, what they're doing in the West Bank, what they're doing in terms of suppression of speech, of who's in prison. And it seemed, I'll say it in my own voice, one thing that's hard for me is what seems to be the, correct me please, I hope, the consensus in Israel that somehow Palestinian lives, 20,000 of them, are less valuable than Jewish lives, that there is that a misperception on my part? Is that just an effect of, is that a traumatic reaction of being attacked? Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I don't speak to everyone. I don't know what everyone's thinking. So I also can just have like a perception. And I'm also obviously somewhat limited also by the people that I hang around with. I don't know anyone who feels that way. Even people who are not against the war, I think the perception is more like we're fighting back. We're attacked, we're fighting back. We're trying to get rid of Hamas. And there's a lot of casualties, you know, in the process of trying to do that. I don't know anyone who would say, let's kill all those Palestinians. I know there are people who say that, just like they're Palestinians who would say, let's kill all the Jews. But I don't think that's the general public feeling. You know, obviously there's like this more extremist element in Israeli society that might be thinking that, but I don't think that, that's certainly not mainstream Israel, I would say. And I think you also have to remember that people here are not seeing the same news probably that you're seeing, or that certainly not that Palestinians are seeing, and they're not seeing the news that we're seeing. That's even a question too, if Palestinians even know what really happened on October 7th and how much they're, I mean, I know that some of them don't think that what happened happened. So I don't know how much we're seeing about what's going on in Gaza exactly. But and there's, of course, there's trauma. There's definitely trauma and fear, and this idea that, you know, we need to do what it takes so this doesn't happen again. I've heard people use the word also revenge. I don't know. I guess it's hard to define what revenge is exactly. I was thinking about it today. Like, if you have this instinct, I'm just thinking out loud because I was thinking about this when I was driving today, that like someone punches you and then you like automatically punch them back. So like, what is that? Is that, I mean, I don't know if I would automatically punch somebody back, but that's, I think a lot of people have that instinct. And is that revenge? Is it trying to defend yourself? I really, really do think, at least the people that I talk to are really very afraid of, like, physically, like, afraid for, like, a bigger war breaking out, of Hamas attacking again. So the way I react to that for myself is, like, that the answer is peace. The answer is some kind of agreement. The answer is to not keep fighting all the time violently. So that's, like, how I feel about it. A lot of other people might feel like, okay, the answer is just trying to defeat them, you know, that this is war and we need to win. So there's a lot of this, like, in Israel, there are all these signs of, you know, we need to win, yachad nenatzeach, and that together we'll win. And there is a lot of that. But I also hear a lot of people saying that they're skeptical about that now, and can we even win anyway, and what does winning mean? So that's a lot of I think what's going on. I think it's much more complex than, oh, we just want to kill a lot of Palestinians, or our lives are worth more than theirs. Because if you feel like it's us against them, then it's not necessarily that yours is worth more than theirs, but just like, of course you care about your own life more than someone else's life if someone's going to kill you. So you would kill them, you know, before they kill you. Like, that's just, and it's also in part of on the Torah too. So I think there's a lot of that. Yeah.
And I guess whoever has to make, I mean, these life or death decisions is in a very, you know, in I'm talking about these Israeli military, the government, mm-hmm. I mean, a very difficult moral situation, yeah. that so much of the world just doesn't seem to see. But and I feel like it's even just reading constantly, it's very hard to know what constitutes the punching back, the desire for revenge, and what's necessary to safeguard against future attacks. And maybe that's where which acts had to happen, which was collective punishment, and still don't know. But it seems like for you at some point you crossed a barrier where you're like, more operations are not going to make us safer. It sounds like you've reached that at some point, or continue to hold that position.
Yeah. And so that, and for me, it was about kind of the end point, and which maybe sounds callous too, right? Because then is it, oh, so I don't care about the people dying. Like, that's not true. And it's hard to see. I guess I like to think of it more like people dying all over, and like, how can we put an end to this killing back and forth? The moral dilemma piece of it. That was something that So I do spiritual direction, and some of the people I work with are rabbis and rabbinical students. And like one rabbi that I was, that I do spiritual direction for already a number of years. And she was talking about how being like a more left-wing rabbi to a more centrist right-wing kind of community, and how on this issue, you know, how that was challenging for her, and how she, how she became much more sensitive to Jewish fear and to a connection, like a more visceral connection to Israel and to the Israeli people, and understanding some of the Holocaust trauma too. But I was bringing this up because I said something to her about how this was early on in the war, and how I saw this as a moral dilemma, and like she hadn't put it that way or heard it put that way. And for me, that was very clear what was going on, that this question of so what do you do when Hamas is putting their headquarters, you know, under hospitals or under people's houses, and when they're putting hostages in people's homes, and it's not so clear what
they keep going on or taking from, you know, stealing supplies from ambulances or digging, you know, we've seen like tunnels starting underneath kids' bedrooms, like
exactly. So so that seems to me like a very difficult moral dilemma, and because I also have these soldiers hanging out at my house when they're on leave, you know, with my son in the backyard, and they're talking, and that's they talk about that. It's very hard to know what to do in those situations, and they're also afraid being there, and yeah, afraid and I don't know because I'm not an expert or a military person, but the feeling that I get is that the policy, I don't think that the IDF is telling soldiers like just kill everybody you see and just kill as many Palestinians as you can. I do think that they are. I don't know what they're being told exactly, but I don't think that that's what they're being told.
You mentioned your spiritual directory. I wonder if you have more that you could say, you know, given confidentiality, in general, what you're encountering. I imagine that the people you do spiritual direction with who are in the U.S., rabbinical students, rabbis, talk more to you about what's going on with them vis-a-vis Israel and the war. So you just mentioned a greater awareness of the fear that people have and the buttons that are pushed from the Shoah. Are there other things that you encounter?
Yeah, so much. I have directees who are in Hillel's and on campus, so that's a whole other story too, and trying to support both the people who are anti-Zionist and the people who are Zionist, and people's own journeys with this and where they, you know, if they're just trying to figure it out themselves. And one thing that's been maybe challenging for me, but it is like me being here and them being there, and like things that you were just talking about, Jacob, of like your perception there and my perception here. And I'll admit, like seeing the day after October 7th, seeing people demonstrating against Israel was very hard for me. And so now, like if I'm demonstrating for a ceasefire, I feel like that's very different 4 months later, living in Israel very different than seeing people on October 8th demonstrating for a ceasefire, which to me, you know, was saying that like Israel has had no right to exist, really, because what does that mean? A ceasefire when somebody's, when the other side, you know, Hamas was certainly not going to be stopping. And so, like, are you just supposed to lay down and say, okay, well, we surrender to you? No, I didn't understand what that message was of the ceasefire on October 8th. So I think that's one thing that I can say as somebody sitting here who is like a peace activist and a shared society activist and a partnership, right? And even my Palestinian friends in Israel were condemning Hamas. So it was very strange to see, like, specifically Jews, maybe, but not only, like celebrating Hamas or saying, wow, finally, you know, Palestine is free. And I felt like that was like out of touch with what's going on the ground here.
This is Brian speaking to you about 3 weeks after our conversation with Haviva, with a quick follow-up note. Haviva wrote me after our interview to further clarify that from her perspective, a key difference between the protests in Israel for a ceasefire and those around the world after October 7th is that in Israel, quote, we are calling for a mutual ceasefire and the return of all hostages, end quote.
This is Rabbi Jacob Staub again. Have you been moved by this conversation? Have you found a new perspective on the Evolve website? Have you deepened your Jewish practice with resources from ritualwell.org? Has your life been impacted by a Reconstructionist rabbi or community? Consider making a gift to Reconstructing Judaism. We bring you this podcast and so much more. We partner with people and communities to envision the kind of Jewish communities we all want to be part of and set out to build them. There's a donate link in our show notes here, and you can also give at the Evolve homepage and click support us. Now back to our conversation with Rabbi Haviva. We were talking a few months ago and you looked at me on Zoom and said, don't give up on us, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if you can speak to that. Like, there are the temptation for people, for non-Israeli Jews, is, God, this is awful. Is it ever going to end? I don't, you know, the polls say there is an increase in non-Zionists among young people, Jewish and non-Jewish. Talk for a few minutes about why we shouldn't give up on you.
Okay. So what does that mean? Don't give up on us. Like, who's the us, right? Like, I don't even know if I define myself as a Zionist, but that doesn't have to do with whether I think Jews should not be allowed to live on this land. So for me, like, I separate whether it needs to be a Jewish state, what it needs to be exactly, like how you need to define it. But this was actually, and then I'll get to answer your question, but for me, I'll share something that for years I have not been singing along in the Hatikva, because I find that it's a totally Jewish-centered anthem, and there are people who are not Jews who live in this country, and I feel like it's alienating to them, and that we could come up with something that's more inclusive. And so at the end of all these demonstrations, you know, for the year before October 7th, we'd all, you know, they'd end with the Hatikva, not the ones that were standing demonstrations, but the more mainstream ones, and we end with Hatikva. And I would just, you know, I wouldn't sing along, but I would stand there respectfully. And after October 7th, Jacob and kids, we went to the hostage square in Tel Aviv. And someone was a Frate, and somebody sang was singing, and then he sang the Hatikva at the end. And the house of his families were standing behind him. And I just started to sing along, and I hadn't sung in a really long time. And I was crying, like it touched this place inside me of reminding myself that like I have a right to be here too. You know, that I have a right to not be taken from my home and taken across to Gaza, you know, like that. And that really, like, it brought home to me that feeling of, and I've always felt this way. I've always felt that Jews and Palestinians have a right to be here through all my evolutions and learnings and growings and learning more about the Palestinian narrative and all my activist work. I always felt that Jews and Palestinians both have a right to live on this land and that we need to find a way to do it together. So October 7th definitely like brought out this part in me that was like, yes, you know, I also have a right to be here. And I feel I've not like affirmed that for me. I feel like don't give up on this dream of that we can live here together in peace. That's what it means like for me. It's not like don't give up on the Zionist dream, or, you know, I think it's evolved and I think it's still evolving. Just like I think the Palestinian approach of all or nothing, you know, we want all of the land or we'll just is also, I think, needs to change. I think that both peoples need to realize that we have to share this land, whether it's going to be two separate states, whether it's going to be one state that we can all live in together, whether it's going to be some kind of confederation, whether it's going to be one land for everyone, two homelands, one people. I don't remember the slogan.
One land, two people, right? What is that?
One homeland, two peoples, maybe that's what it is. So I think like don't give up on this idea that we can work it out, that we can live here in peace someday. And what we often say here, the Palestinians and Jews who are doing this work, we often say none of us are going anywhere. Like we're all here to stay, and so we just need to find a way to live together. I think it's also sometimes people living not here don't understand that most of the Jews here don't have anywhere to go. It's not this like colonial image that a lot of people have of like white people came from Europe and, you know, killed all the Palestinians and took over the land is not that historically what happened. And a lot of the people here, first of all, aren't from Europe at all, and were actually even kicked out of the country that they were living in this part of the world. It's much more complex. And so this idea is that, yeah, like that a lot of people really don't have anywhere else to go, and also that both peoples feel connected to this land. And so even like friends of mine who live, let's say, in Nazareth, you know, and I say to them, well, if there's a Palestinian state, where would you go? And they say, oh, I'm staying in Nazareth. Like, Nazareth is my home. If Nazareth is part of Israel, it's part of Palestine, like, I'll just stay in Nazareth.
So you've given us a little bit of your hopeful sense. I think I want to close by asking where you're drawing your hope from, or what you're doing to sustain yourself during this time. Because you might not be writing fiction, but you're continuing your activism. You're out there writing. You're teaching. I mean,
So I can tell you about this really nice event I did. I just did with kids from here and in Kfar Manda, the Kfar Manda. It's the Arab village across the way from Kanaton. This we just did a couple of days ago, but then in general, this kind of work. So somebody donated 100 trees to Standing Together in our area, to our circle, to do some kind of activity that would bring together Palestinian and Jewish Israelis. And so I had this idea to do tree planting with youth from like neighboring Jewish and Arab villages and towns. And so we started here in Hanaton with kids from here and kids from Kfar Manda across the way. And it was so, so nice. We didn't plant the trees yet. We're going to do that later this week. But we had a meeting of kids just to meet each other. And I started it by saying to, before the kids from Kfar Manda came over to our, to us, I said to the other kids, like, how many of you have friends in Kfar Manda across the way? And I knew it was a trick question, you know, because none of them do, obviously. They're not in school together. They have no, nothing, you know, and they don't even necessarily speak the same language. So then I said, well, you know, I have friends there and I have friends in a bunch of villages around here. And I think that's a shame that you don't have a chance to meet these kids. So they're going to come over and you're going to meet them. And so they came and it was so amazing. Like, I wasn't sure what was going to happen. I didn't know how much Hebrew that the Arab kids had and how much, you know, Arabic. They both learn each other's languages in school, but they don't use them so much. And they came over and we did these like ice-breaking games. And literally like within 10 minutes, the kids were all just like chatting and talking and having fun and showing each other things on their phones. And then they went and took the kids over to the like park and where they were playing soccer and climbing on things and doing games. It was amazing. It was absolutely so, so, so nice. And so so that kind of stuff gives me help doing all this kind of this work on the ground, because it seems that the political situation is so dire, and that makes me really depressed, seeing what's going on politically and what the leadership is doing, and but the people like caring about each other. And even just after October 7th, even put aside the Palestinian Israeli, you know, whatever stuff, but even just the government is so dysfunctional, and the grassroots here just came out, as I said, like in their homes to meet World War displays. We're going to volunteer. Even people who picked up guns and like drove down to the envelope, the guy's envelope, and just were saving, like literally going and saving people, like from the Nova Festival, like civilians just went down there. And then and like Bedouin who live in that area were driving in with their trucks and saving people and driving them out and risking their lives, and some didn't make it. Just that the hope that, you know, just the government's such a mess, but the people here, it's a special place in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Well, I think speaking for myself, I really I appreciate your time. Thank you for this interview, and keep it up. Your writings and Facebook posts like give me and so many others a real window into what's going on, and show us that there are folks who are brave enough to reach across divides and you know, try to make peace. So.
Well, that's something I'm trying to do with the Facebook post, is things that you don't see in the news necessarily, so that people can know that that's happening too. Yeah.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you. And be safe and healthy, you and everyone else.
I'm trying.
Amen. What did you think of today's episode? I want to hear from you. Send me your questions, comments, feedback. You can reach me at my real actual email address, bschwartzman@reconstructingjudaism.org. We'll be back next month with an all new episode. Evolve, Groundbreaking Jewish Conversations, is executive produced by Rabbi Jacob Staub and edited by Sam Walks. Our theme song, Ilufinu, is by Rabbi Miriam Margolz. This show is a production of Reconstructing Judaism. I'm your host, Brian Schwartzman, and I'll see you next time.